corroboration for him, or other evidence of Niall's guilt. But for the moment, Hobie's done his job. Lavinia Campbell is gone from the state's case. In the sheriff's office, there are dressing rooms and showers, basic fare, rusted lockers, concrete floors, the reek of disinfectant. The judges, who have free access, refer to this area, in irony, as the club. As a former cancer patient who has read all of the studies about the ancillary routes to health, I skip lunch at least twice a week, and in a raveled sweatshirt and leggings of spandex, time-defying miracle fiber of the 90s, lumber off from the courthouse down Cushing Boulevard for 40 minutes of intermittent power walking and jogging. Rosario, the gatekeeper at the judge's entrance, a tiny fellow in the blue sheriff deputy's uniform, speeds me on my way with his standard farewell.
Go get him, Judge.
When I return, he will sweep the door aside and say,
Welcome to Fantasy Island.
I have never been certain if he is mocking himself or the eerie atmosphere of the courthouse, where we are always rubbing shoulders with people whom, in other circumstances, you would cross the street to avoid. Boys who shout too loud, who strut about with an abject, thuggish glower, surrounded by menace like a dark halo. The federal building was full of officious clerks and marshals, pumped up with the majesty of the United States. But in the Kindle County courthouse, there is a humble geniality among the lawyers, the deputies, the clerks, a quiet need to reassure ourselves that we belong together to a community of decent folk. I race along with Mahler on my headset, my heart kicking as I twist down the pavement to avoid the jurors, attorneys, and families on their way to lunch. A couple of the lawyers, whose names I don't recall or never knew, wave to me in an eager way as I shoot by. Hiya, Your Honor. It's one of the last decent days of the year. The light is weakening and dismal winter clouds, heavy as quilting, move randomly from remote quarters of the sky to momentarily darken the day with the awesome suddenness of a primitive curse. But the sun returns periodically, and the air is bearable, pushing 40. Soon, Mother Nature will prove she is at heart an angry witch. Winter in the Middle West. You're never quite ready. Not far from the exit, I hear my name. Sunny! More or less yodeled, carried to me on the sharp wind. Pushing back the earphones, I expect to greet another judge, but it is instead Seth, trotting to catch up. Oh, for Christ's sake, I mutter beneath my breath. I'm the one who started this yesterday, who crossed the moat. But this is starting to feel like junior high school. In the same blue sport coat and scuffed shoes he's worn each day, Seth arrives with a self-aggrandizing smile. The fringe of hair above his ears, going colorless, is fluffed up by the wind. I was afraid I missed you. Your secretary, Marion, she said you'd come out here. Marietta? Slow death, I think. Chinese tortures. I am truly going to kill her. I stand there, jogging in place, toe-dancing in my sockinies and sweatshirt, and give him my loftiest judicial manner, all walls. What can I do for you, Seth? He draws back with a wet-eyed, wounded look that seems somehow typical of him these days. I'm holding you up, he says at last. Come on, I'll run with you. He moves a few paces ahead and motions for me to join him. In his street shoes and blazer, he leads the way along the avenue with a practiced gait. I'm only going to bother you for a second. I just wanted you to know something. You asked me yesterday about Hobie and Dubinsky, and I thought about that all night. And I think I get it. I think I know why you asked. Forget it, Seth. I see what's coming. He had dinner with Hobie, and they planned a response. Seth's here as a guided missile. This is just the reason I vowed to have nothing to do with him. We're not having this discussion. No, I want you to understand. I don't know what Hobie's doing. I love him, but take it from me. Hobie T. Tuttle can be a treacherous fellow, so whatever he cooked up, it's with Stu, not me. I'm not part of it. Hobie and Niall, neither of them are even talking to me. Okay? That's all. That's enough. One more line, one more word, and I'll have to do something. Stop and shout for the police. But he allows me to proceed in silence, galloping heavy-footed down the walk. We have reached Homer Park, which boasts a circular tarred walkway. In times past, the park district was a notorious tub of grease, with patronage jobs and no-bid contracts the haven for no-nose politicians like Toots Nuccio, who sometimes carried his Tommy gun to city council meetings in his clarinet case. These days, as the city grows poorer, so do the parks. The programs that brightened my life as a child, the crafts, classes, and summer camps, are gone. Even routine maintenance has failed. In this park, for reasons I have never figured out, the trees have all been topped. They ring the tarmac path like amputees, barkless, knotted. The lawn, dying in the early winter, is bare in many patches, strewn with trash and leaves. It is a safe haven, though, in the daylight hours. Latino moms in their cloth coats wheel their bundled babies. Pedestrians bound for the center city cross the park to transfer bus lines. Like a river running through a canyon, US 843, with its thrum and fumes, is a block away and 200 feet down. As Seth remains beside me, easily keeping pace, I am engaged in reassessment. Hobie T. Tuttle can be treacherous. He and Dubinsky cooked something up. It's hard to imagine Seth as Hobie's emissary and bringing those messages. I'm even briefly tempted to ask what he thinks Hobie's up to, but better sense prevails. With Seth, I have to maintain a firm grip. Jesus, it's cold out here. He's attempting to ease the silence with a joke and rubs the open expanse of his scalp. No natural protection, he says. Seth, am I supposed to feel sorry for you because you're bald? Going, he says. Going bald, forehead challenged. Let me tell you the truth, Seth. A woman after 40 has to worry about everything. Top to bottom, her chest sagging, the onset of menopause, bones going soft. If she's had kids, her back end isn't likely to fit the jeans from 20 years ago, and maybe her bladder's weak, too. So it doesn't really break my heart that men go bald. In fact, and I'm not usually like this, I'm glad they have something to worry about. And to top it off, the truth is, I don't think it looks all that bad. Makes a guy appear mature, which, frankly, is a rare quality in a lot of men. So I'm not sorry for you, Seth. Holy smokes, he says. What's got you so cranky? Come on, Seth. You're following me down the street on one of my 2 free hours in the week. And frankly, every time I talk to you, there's this lament, as if I'm supposed to pity you when the fact is I've got a job to do, which I've already explained. Oddly, he does not offer the defenses I would have expected. Right, he says instead, and his eyes fall to his shoes. I realize suddenly, guiltily, that I've been trying to drive him off by picking a fight. His face, in the interval, remains buffeted by strong feeling. My son died, he says then. You asked what was dramatic for me. Yesterday, that was dramatic. He has tried, it seems, to strike the tone of historical distance we maintained about our lives a day ago. But the edges of his voice do not hold up. I stop at once, while he flies on another 20 paces, so completely unable to look at me that it's that long before he notices I'm not beside him. We've reached the tarred oval, and he trudges back to me, against the backdrop of the tortured amputee elms, his posture withered by the questions he knows are coming next. How long ago, I ask. Almost 2 years, he answers. My God, was he sick? Was he chronic? He was just a little boy, 7 years old. I mean, kind of a difficult little boy, if I'm completely honest. He died in a traffic accident. He waits a moment and searches the pewter sky for the sun, where the dark accumulation of clouds has temporarily milked the daylight of everything vital. I was driving.
Oh, God.
It wasn't my fault. That's what everybody says. This guy was drunk, just out of his mind, 4 times the legal limit, and he ran a light. He hit a curb and came careening right at us. I saw him, you know, maybe out of the corner of my eye. I was trying to move the car forward. It had started forward, but he had the angle on us. It, like, sheared the car in half. 1 second, I'm sitting there telling Isaac to mind his fingers and his nose, and afterwards, the one thing I was grateful for was that I didn't have to hear him scream. And yet, Jesus, how can your child die without even making a sound? By now, my arms have closed around my sides to cope with the rampant pain. I try a few words of consolation, but his palm rises at once, and I realize this must be one of the worst parts. Listening to people grope for words in hopes of expressing an agony so much his, not theirs. Even then, I can't help saying the same thing again and again. I'm sorry. So sorry. I had no idea, Seth. Your life seems so exposed in your column. There hasn't been a word, has there? I hate talking about it. I'm rotten with self-pity as it is. You see it. Everybody sees it. I'm just a running sore. I find I have taken his hand. Sweat has trailed down beneath his watch band and the sleeve of his dress shirt. His other hand is against the bridge of his nose, in an effort at self-control. And the guy who hit you, is he in prison? Dumb question, I think at once. Stupid. Trying to press the whole thing within my own horizons, because the thought of what he's been through so frightens me. Oh, sure. He got 15 years. He had a record, a big record. Some poor, fucked-up black guy. Stolen car, the whole shot. He pled guilty. I never even had to look at him again. Lucy went to court for the sentencing. I guess she cried and carried on. I mean, what's the point? I never think about him, the guy. I think, you know, if I'd moved faster, if I'd pressed the accelerator harder, if... He scans the park. A 13-year-old, hat on backwards and smoking a cigarette, whizzes by us on rollerblades. We're going to freeze out here, he says. He starts to jog then, and I follow, walking fast. He slows to keep my pace. And Lucy, is Lucy crazy with it, is she? She's crazy. Not that I'm in any position to talk. We're both out of our minds, but in different ways. This is what's between Lucy and him, I realize. It must be. We travel half the oval without words, but he can tell what I've been thinking. It's not like she blames me, he says. At least, not the way I blame myself. But like this, running. 6 months ago, we started jogging together before dinner. We'd take the dog. We bought these lights you wear on your elbows. We had matching suits. But how can you enjoy it? You can't. You think this is not how our life is supposed to be. We're supposed to be at home. We're supposed to be tied down. We're supposed to be yelling at Isaac to turn off the TV, to start on his homework. It's not bitter with us. We just can't find a way to move on. I wouldn't imagine Lucy knows how to be bitter. Not a clue. Still incredibly good-natured? Incredibly. I assume she found a career beyond astrology? Yeah. But she still believes in it. And reincarnation. And ethical shopping. And the music of the spheres. You'd call her New Age. He marvels at her with a toss of his head. For the past year, he says, Lucy has been the director of a local soup kitchen in Seattle. He draws an ironic picture of her on a first-name basis with all the losers, junkies, drunks, and nuts to whom she extends a helping hand. Lucy is a person of boundless generosity, a collector of strays, mother to anyone in need, whether it's a bird with a crippled wing, her beautician who needed English lessons, or their cleaning lady, for whose eldest daughter, Lucy, by dint of an 8-month crusade, won admission to Bellingham Country Day, where Seth's own children were not accepted. Do I sound like I resent this? Seth asks. Maybe, I answer. Then I'm striking the wrong note. I'm amazed that her heart goes out so fully to people she barely knows, while I'm always in this muddle, trying to find a way to feel enough for the people I'm supposed to care about. I hope it works out for you, Seth. I do too. It's a mess now. You've been through it, the friends, the house. I mean, all of a sudden, nothing belongs to you anymore. Stuff that was yours forever. People see you coming and they have this look on their face like you goosed them. I'm glad to be out of there for a while. Charlie's pals were at the U. Ray Napew was acerbic, terribly funny about everyone but himself. Carter Melk, another poet, was gentle but wordless. I miss both of them, but not the university, with its intense secret rivalries, reminiscent of a medieval court. "So what did your chump do?" he asks. "Charlie? Why is he a chump?" "He let you go, didn't he?" I left him, finally. We took turns over the years, but I got the last curtain. Charlie. Something within me shrieks. The thought of him remains impossible. It's like some trauma I can never fully recall, a bad fall, a beating. With Charlie, what I can't recollect is what I ever saw in him. I remember as a fact, like the capitals of the 50 states, that for many years I felt under his spell. But he was a cad, autocratic, self-absorbed. I reestablished that point 100 times each day. This morning, waking up, I had a clear memory of how often I was scratched by his toenails in bed at night. No matter how reasoned my appeal, he refused to cut them. "And what did he do? You mean to irritate me?" "No. That's a short list, right? Guys are so predictable. He didn't love you enough, he didn't pay enough attention, he got hung up on someone else." "Right, right, and right," I say. "No. How'd he make money? Doctor, lawyer, Indian chief?" "A poet." "No way. It's true. He didn't make much money. He's got a teaching appointment at a university near Cincinnati now. But there was a long period while we were together when he refused to teach. He had a feud at the English department. He was a mailman then." We've made a full circuit of the walk. 3 blocks from the courthouse and the depleted south rim of the center city, the lower shapes of a struggling residential area rise up. Mercados, taverns, shingle-sided frame houses, the wonderful gilded church spire of the Serbian church, notched like a key to the gates of heaven. "So he hooked up with a rich lawyer, huh?" I laugh at the idea. "No, Charlie never approved of my legal career. Rules, forms, those are the kinds of particulars he always thought were trivial. The detritus of living." That's from one of his poems. "Even when I was a prosecutor, he didn't see the point of what I was doing." "He wanted the guilty to go free?" "I think he just would have preferred to banish them. Ship them all elsewhere. Make it go away. That was Charlie's usual approach to a problem." I had always thought I saw life more or less Charlie's way, and was shocked to discover that the law was the sort of thing for which I had some gift. A few times in my last term of law school, I went to court. I was working with the state defender's office, allowed under local procedure to stand up in court on little misdemeanor cases. Once, afterwards, I went to the food store from the courthouse, and there, as I was looking at the shining, clustered heads of a pint of blackberries, I realized that what I had been doing a few minutes before, my ease in addressing a judge, begging mercy for the wretched and the weak, was quite beyond Charlie, who was anguished with words, not merely in his poems, but even in contemplating what might be spoken in his classroom to 18-year-olds, who, for the most part, wanted no more wisdom from him than some surefire way to get through English 1. Somehow, this thought of our relative abilities had never come to me in precisely that fashion. I was accustomed, in fact, to thinking of Charlie as possessed of something empyrean and magical, the stuff, if not of genius, at least of art. But now, in the grocery, I suddenly took heart from my moment at the rostrum, From my exchange of sharp words with the grubby prosecutor and the dutiful wag of the judge's head, granting my forlorn client a generous sentence of 90 days probation. And the thought had followed then, part of an inevitable sequence, that in a certain worldly way, I was stronger than Charlie. I was hardier, the better survivor. And all that seemed remarkable was how unsurprising it was. I had known this always, and none of it, I recognized, had occurred unwillingly. "Was your breakup bitter?" Seth asks. I just make a sound at the recollection. Across the oval, I recognize another runner, Linda Larson, Judge Bailey's clerk, and I wave. "I'm bitter about Charlie, but not my marriage. I'm actually beginning to see it as a useful phase for both of us. It got Charlie away from Rebecca, his first wife. No one should be stuck with Rebecca. And it got me through my illness. He proposed to me when I had no hair from the radiation."
"You had no hair and he had a wife?"
"Exactly. Modern," he says. "Postmodern," I answer. "Sometimes when I'm in the dumps about it, I wonder, of course." "About what?" "About whether I meant to leave Charlie all along. You know, did I always know my marriage was doomed?" He appears confused. "I mean my mother," I say. "Okay, I was raised by this woman alone, and here I am doing the same thing. And I wonder if I didn't feel a certain destiny there. The older I get, the more like her I'm afraid I am."
"You're nothing like her, Sonny, nothing."
Even as we continue moving, he reaches across and grips my wrist urgently, much as I gripped his. His green eyes are enlarged. "She was crazy." As if pierced by an airborne spear, I am suddenly revisited by the pain of that, remembering how weird everybody thought Zora was. I could never stand to say it to myself, that Zora was not ordinary, not right. Tiny, wall-eyed from a childhood accident with firecrackers, she spoke with urgency and volume, always regaling me with memorized quotations from writers of leftist spirit, Walt Whitman through Maud Gunn, and free association gossip about figures from the labor movement. She was on 1,000 obscure quests. She prowled junk shops and used bookstores seeking treasures, apothecary bottles, button boxes, squared off paper clips with little wire curlicues, writings that were lost, a rare translation of Ruben Dario's Songs of Life and Spirit, George Eliot's Felix Holt, The Radical. She always addressed me in lavishly endearing terms, "My precious darling, my treasure," and at the best moments, often, it was true. To be the object of all of Zora's galvanic passion was to stand at the center of the world. But there were other times when she was, in the perfect phrase, carried away. She once lost me in the maelstrom she provoked at a local PTA meeting, where she had appeared to rail against the inclusion of the words "under God" in the Pledge of Allegiance. In that era, when men didn't babysit and working women were not expected to spend their earnings on childcare, I was often in tow, at organizing meetings, steering committee debates. I played with dolls beneath the dining room tables and was comforted with nickel cokes, while my mother and the others furiously argued doctrine and smoked unfiltered cigarettes. But on this night, Zora was not among friends. Instead, alone, but for me, she confronted the neighborhood of lunch pail tradesmen in which she'd been raised in Kewanee. I was a thin, dark child in my cousin's cast-off cardigan and skirt, clutching a rag doll in some hem of my mother's apparel. Zora gestured wildly, her unraveled voice emerging with expectorant pops at ear-splitting volume as she screamed into a microphone. Ultimately, she was hated from the room.
"Get out, you little Polack nut! You godless commie bitch, go back to Moscow!"
Amid the brandished fists, the agitated throng, I was suddenly alone, pushed along, but uncertain Zora had even noticed I was missing. The moment went on and on. I stood there shrieking, "Mommy!" Then I was retrieved almost absent-mindedly, snatched up by Zora as she turned heel to reply to someone with foul-mouthed invective. That's what Seth and I saw in each other, though neither of us knew it then. We both had come of age with parents who weren't in the swing, exiles from the mainstream. "Tell me about your daughter," he says eventually. That is always pure pleasure. We talk at length, her costumes, her moods, the glories of kindergarten. Heading back, we cross the arc of the concrete overpass above the highway and jog through the little Italian neighborhood, where there are still bakeries with dark awnings and sub-shops with a crucifix or sacred heart over the tables. At this hour, the row of restaurants, Jenna's, Mama Sesta's, are full of a bustling pack of lawyers and courthouse employees. A few tables will remain occupied by men and women who, by whatever whim of fortune, can drink the afternoon away. A gray-haired man wearing a short-sleeved shirt despite the cold stands on the walk before his tiny home, suspiciously eyeing everyone and enjoying a cigarette. A few doors down, there is a wonderful green grocery, Molinari's. In this season, Giacco has beautifully pyramided the citrus. Space heaters glow, running on extension cords right out here on the street. We each buy mountain water and a gorgeous Granny Smith apple. "Jesus, look at me," says Seth as we leave the store. His shirt is soaked through, and even his sport coat is dampened in a semicircle beneath one arm. He'll have to return to the Hotel Gresham, he says, turn his jacket over to the concierge. We walk back toward the courthouse. "You sound awfully heroic about everything," he says. "Got to be tough, the divorce, the cancer, single mom. You're pretty resolute." "The divorce," I say, "was a necessity. And Nikki is my joy. Being sick was terrible, but I think I've pretty much left it behind. Every 6 months or so, I have nightmares, and then there are a few hours when I'm back to scratch. But most days, I'm, what did you say, resolute? Resolved, not heroic. What I'm gladdest of, proud of, is that I didn't become the disease. You know that starts in the hospital? They act as if you don't have a name. They identify you by the procedure. You're a mastectomy. You're a colostomy. It's so easy to think that this illness that's threatening your life is your life. And I got past that. I had my baby. I took this job. Eventually, you say, it happened, she says. Bad things happen. Cancer or divorce, they happen, you know? I mean it. I believe it. And yet the stress of these cataclysms still rebounds. I must have learned more about myself later than most human beings. The last dozen years, the point when my friends from college seemed to have a collection of habits and chosen reflexes they called a life, for me, the same period has been like a bombing run, one explosive surprise after another. Getting sick, getting back together with Charlie, finishing law school, a baby, divorce, the bench. When, I wonder, considering it all, when will I come to rest, be in a place of comfort, or at least repose? Bad things happen, Seth repeats, and I recognize only now what was contained in his observation about being resolute. I feel unconscionably dull, even though my aching for him continues to engird me, as if my ribcage had been irradiated. It takes a long time, Seth. People say. He catches my eye. He's heard it all. I begin to apologize, but he interrupts. I wasn't going to mention it, he says. I really hate... Oh, Seth, I just... It would break my heart to think that any old friend, any person who had so much of my life, might isolate himself with something like this. And what is it that looms up so large? Life, I'd say. To my amazement, I find, although I'm not a teary person by nature, that I am suddenly crying. He briefly throws an arm around me and I dry my nose on the sweatshirt sleeve from which various threads are hanging. Blessedly for both of us, we are behind the courthouse again, where we started. So, you got your exercise, he says, for lack of anything else. I can only smile. Do you ever bring Nikki down here? I'd love to see her. It's an innocent request, but like all else at the moment, it knocks my heart around, thinking about what the sight of friends' kids must be to him, both the torment and the reassurance. Come by sometime. When you visit your father, it's 338 Grove.
It would make the trip worthwhile. Almost, he says.
He looks at me.
You better think about it.
It'll be okay. You're on good behavior, and so am I.
Maybe this weekend?
We're in and out both days.
Whenever.
I hug him quickly. Half a foot shorter than he is, I face him. I now know I was right when he initially stood up in the courtroom, and I thought I detected depletion of some kind. Wreckage. Pain. At the judge's entrance, I leave him with a slogan of our foregone times. You're a good man, Charlie Brown.
April, 1970. Seth. Edgar's expulsion hearings before the Faculty Senate commenced in the third week of April. Sessions ran from 4 in the afternoon to 10 at night, so faculty members could attend without interrupting their classes. After each evening's adjournment, the Edgars and their lawyers met for a lengthy planning session, arguing about strategy, gathering information about coming witnesses. Edgar and June seldom arrived home before 2 or 3 in the morning, only a couple of hours before I had to get up to begin distributing after dark to the coin boxes. As a result, I began putting Niall to bed on the living room sofa in my apartment, roiled up by my imminent flight to Canada and my breakup with Sonny. I was not sleeping soundly and usually heard one of his parents steal in to retrieve him. My life in those weeks felt dismal, stillborn, lost. I could not figure out why I had gone on working, why I had not left yet, except that it didn't seem I could take any substantial step in such a shattered state. My induction remained a couple of weeks off on May 4th. Michael, Niall, and I continued to eat dinner each night, but they were sorry gatherings, silent, except for the TV which Niall watched. I felt Sonny's absence acutely, and Michael, even for Michael, was remote. He claimed his lab was preoccupying him, but I sensed his affair with June had moved to a critical new stage. Those days, each of them seemed tense in the other's presence. After Niall was asleep, I would lie on the mattress on our bedroom floor, where I now slept alone. My transistor clutched to my ear as I listened to the hearing sessions being broadcast on campus radio at Edgar's demand. It reminded me of when I was 7 or 8, and used to lie beneath the blankets at home with the volume on my radio reduced to a secretive hush, listening to the Trappers' baseball games in what I now unexpectedly regarded as happier times. The case against Edgar depended principally on evidence gathered by the campus police. For all the talk of snitches, none had come forward, nor did they appear to be needed. The cops had photographs. They showed the PLP members in their gas masks, and in the picture that became more or less the signature of the case, the mystery woman, the girl who'd shrieked and disappeared, was portrayed emerging from the crowd. One moment, she was unmarked. Then her hand was at her face. Streaks of blood were shown running from her crown, but, said the faculty prosecutor, something was dropping from her hand. A vial? She was identified from mugshots as Laura Lancey, an employee at Bayside Packers, the canning plant where June worked. As Edgar's lawyers pointed out, none of this proved she was not beaten. None of this implicated Edgar, even if it was assumed that Edgar was acquainted with the young woman, which he emphatically denied. But the sequence of photos, the university produced the numbered contact sheets, showed Edgar looking twice across his right shoulder, behind himself to the area of the broad pea gravel plaza, where Laura Lancey eventually emerged. As if he knew something was going to happen there. Edgar's lawyers claimed the negatives had been reversed. In the cafe discussions on Campus Bull, there were few testimonials to Edgar's character. No one supposed he was above violence or lying about it afterwards. He was, after all, a revolutionary, dedicated to undermining bourgeois institutions. But if the university was held to the standards of the system it wanted to defend, its evidence seemed flimsy. Edgar's speech was just that, a speech. The faculty prosecutor tried to establish that Edgar had been on campus aiding the rioters. Two cops claimed they had glimpsed Edgar, supposedly helping the fellow who tumbled from the police station roof, but they admitted being several hundred feet away at the time. The police had also retrieved a shirt from a trash container on campus. It had a 100 flowers armband tied on one sleeve and the pointillistic remnants of what the prosecutor claimed were Edgar's initials printed in the collar years before when he still sent his shirts to the Chinese laundry. The ironies of this bit of evidence were not lost on anyone. I knew Edgar was guilty. Until the hearing, I'd never bothered squarely facing that, but the recognition settled on me with barely a ripple of surprise. But I found myself vaguely hopeful that he would get off anyway, even though I still wasn't sure I was on his side. In my present mood, though, I was sympathetic to anybody forced to confront harsh authority. Over the months, Niall and I found our own rhythm. Sometimes we drew on the sidewalk with chalk. Sometimes he let me play a snarling man who could not reach him when he threw things down at me from the treehouse. He still preferred to watch TV in my apartment, but he favored me with questions now and then, provoked by what he was seeing. Why was the boy mad at the girl on account of the other girl? Sometimes he called on me to confirm the lessons his father relentlessly taught him.
Commercials are just big lies, right?
A lot of them.
They just want you to buy stuff. They're just greedy, right?
Maybe they think what they're selling will help you, man.
They're greedy,
Niall repeated. Greed was a sin that Edgar especially furiously denounced.
They don't want to help the peoples. They don't care about the peoples.
His eyes lit in space, fixing on some troubled judgment about the world and, perhaps, himself. Despite June's persistent efforts to shelter him, Edgar's expulsion hearings inevitably took a toll on Niall as well.
We're moving,
Niall told me one night in April.
Did you know we're getting another house somewhere else?
I tried to be encouraging and suggested that might not be the case.
June says,
his head bobbed emphatically,
are you getting another house with us?
At June's insistence, I made only the vaguest references to my plans. She believed he couldn't handle my departure, particularly with their own situation so unsettled, a judgment that seemed well supported by Niall's surprisingly morose response when Sunny had moved out. Sunny had spent time with Niall only at meals, but she was always kind to him, and from the start, she had been far better attuned to his moods than I was. Back in the winter, I'd complained about the way Niall seemed to disappear into the TV, immune to any other distraction.
Don't you see he's depressed?
She had answered. She was seated, legs akimbo, on our bed, surrounded by books like tribute.
Depressed? He's a kid. What's he got to be depressed about?
Weren't you depressed as a child? Isn't that what you're always talking about?
I was terrified, man. I'm not sure that's depressed. Why? Were you depressed?
She shrugged and turned a page, intent. But some impulse escaped her.
I mean, baby, she said, you have to look at that house. Think what that's like to be the child of a revolutionary, someone who's always spouting off about these visions of what's bigger and more important than anything or anyone, including you.
You mean Niall's got, like, sibling rivalry with Chairman Mao? I was, as usual, greatly entertained by myself and could not understand Sunny's sizzling, vexed expression or why she turned back to her books so bitterly. Yet she was right. Niall was one of those kids for whom growing up just seemed to be hard. He was always in scrapes of one kind or another at school, and often perceived himself as the victim of terrible physical ailments. Any cut, no matter how microscopic, inspired prolonged weeping. He sometimes wore as many as 6 adhesive strips on his limbs. One night in the fall, when I was alone with him, I had heard Niall padding to the John. I was startled because he had never gotten up before. He had stripped off his clothes and stood shivering. He wore only a huge diaper which lapped gigantically around him.
"I'm wet,"
he said, hardly a necessary announcement. The smell was strong. I washed him as he quivered, his eyes dark like his mother's, heavy with sleep.
"Tell my mom I goed,"
he said. During the hearings, I covered my sofa in a plastic sheet and assured Niall that I was unconcerned about accidents. With my departure at hand, I didn't care if the place reeked. Throughout the months, June had never addressed the subject with me. She never told me what to do to help, or confessed that this was why she'd insisted Niall sleep in his own bed. It was one more secret of their household, which, like the rest of what I knew, I was expected to maintain in silence. The night Edgar finished his testimony, he showed up to collect Niall. I had heard every word on the campus radio and thought he had done a fine job in his own behalf. He denied any intention of inciting to riot, said he'd never met Laura Lancey, and claimed he had returned to his apartment as soon as the demonstration at the ARC turned to violence. He had no role, he said, in the ensuing melee on campus. He sounded equable, the soul of reason. I suspected that much of what he said was true, that he had been careful never to meet Laura Lancey. But his voice did not betray him in any way, even in the moments that I knew he was uttering unvarnished lies. On cross-examination, the prosecutor contented himself with the text of Edgar's many classroom lectures and public speeches. "In addressing a group, have you ever repeated the saying, 'Political power grows out of the barrel of a gun?'" "Of course I have. That's a matter of theory." "You have called for armed struggle, for violence?" "At the proper time." "And who is it who decides the time, Dr. Edgar?" The defense lawyer objected, and eventually the Senate president cut off questioning. I told him now I thought it had gone well. "To no avail," he answered. "The end is a foregone conclusion. I must admit, that was always one of my favorite theological puzzles. Why did Jesus say what he did on the cross? You know the part I'm referring to? About his father forsaking him. Hadn't the poor fool known what was coming? Did his father send him down here with no warning? What kind of relationship did they have, any old way?" He laughed in his usual quiet fashion when something amused him alone. I asked about the closing arguments, scheduled for tomorrow, but Edgar appeared uninterested. His eyes fell to the 2 cardboard boxes of Sonny's belongings she'd left behind. I'm sure he assumed they were mine. "When will you go?" he asked. "Next week." This was the 2nd week in a row that I'd said that. At times, I feared I would never propel myself, that I'd wait until some ugly vortex, the FBI or secret military dragoons, sucked me down to a blackish fate. For the moment, though, I used the hearings as my excuse. I would go as soon as the Edgars were settled again.
"And your parents, are they still hounding you?"
he asked. "Relentlessly." My mother had taken money, her own funds, her knipple, saved out of the household money, and bought an open ticket to Vancouver. My father said she had also packed a suitcase. There was only one in the house I knew of, a brown lacquered valise hard as an insect shell, and I imagined it now poised by the front door.
"Perhaps you should rethink being kidnapped."
We laughed. I had, at moments, returned to the idea. It had given me a vicious thrill to imagine my father pinioned that way, between his child and his money. An antique theme. Midas came to mind, although I tended to think more about Jack Benny, one of my father's favorites, and his famous bit where a robber with a gun and a mask accosts Jack. "Your money or your life," the robber demands, and Jack, after a splendid long take, answers, "I'm thinking, I'm thinking." Driving my delivery route, turning things over obsessively, like rolling dice, I thought I could measure the true probabilities. Each time, I pushed my imagination further along the train of likely events. My father was too shrewd not to sense the ruse. Of course. He'd see it was far too convenient, far too coincidental. But my mother would never rouse herself to disbelief, no matter how unlikely the threat to my well-being. She would cry. She would pull on the sleeves of her dress, fumble with her hands, follow him about crying all the time, begging him in German, shrieking and beleaguering him. He would give in. He would part with the money, suspecting all along that I had exacted a price to leave him in peace. It's like I said a while ago, he'd pay in the end, and I'd be no better off than I was to start. It's not really workable.
Oh, there's always a way. It's only details, Edgar added, as if particulars were not the stuff of life.
I was seated in the living room armchair, picking at the threadbare patch where the ticking showed through. You don't honestly think I should do this, man, do you?
Seth, what I think you should do is join the armed struggle. But I'm not so foolish as to believe that's likely to occur right now.
He'd picked up Niall's stuffed animal and his blanket, and he put them down now on the sofa, where the boy still slept, oblivious to our hushed conversation.
May I tell you a story? This is the worst story I know. The worst. I hate even to think about it, but I have a point to make.
He sat down on a milk crate we used as a coffee table and paused to hike each of his pants legs, his preparations deepening the mood.
When I was 14 years old, Edgar said, I went with my father to the Overlook Valley Hunt Club. What it is in the life of the South, what it is that when there are so many as 6 prosperous white families in a 50-square-mile region, they will organize themselves in either a hunt club or a country club or some similar pastoral enterprise. What it is, I have never fully explained to myself, but my father, like his father, was a member of this club, and on Saturday afternoons, as his week was at an end and he prepared himself for our Sabbath on Sunday, he would adjourn to this club and drink Tennessee whiskey until the sun had set and my father was drunk as a lord. I was terribly embarrassed to see my father in that condition. He took on a high red color, bright as a geranium, and it was also an unscrupled breach of his own religious principles, for which he never made one word of apology. I hated to go with him, but I was raised in the kind of family where you simply said, "Yes, Daddy," when something was required, and so I went along on many a Saturday, becoming, I suppose, educated in a tradition which I'm sure he expected me to take up as my own, listening to large men with the characteristic names Bear and Doghead and Billy Ray, drinking bourbon with mint and sugar water, telling about critters they had shot and women they had known. All right? He asked. With this story, Edgar was at home in every sense. His lexicon had changed and his accent deepened. He had told the tale many times, I knew, practiced it, but Edgar held me as he always did. I nodded quickly for him to go on. Well, the tiny little town of Overlook was near the club, and you had to drive directly through it to get back to my father's plantation. It was like most little southern towns, white and colored patches separated by the railroad tracks. Not so much as a street light yet, because we hadn't gotten rural electrification. And one evening, when my father had drunk himself silly, turned red as those dirt roads, just absolutely radiating the heat of drink, he came flying round the corner and plowed smack into the front of some old shivering heap that was stopped politely at a sign there in the colored section. I must say, this wreck shook up both my daddy and me. He bounced his head against the windshield and took a good lick there, and began spouting a skinny little stream of blood that ran down into his eyes. But finally, we collected ourselves and looked out to see some poor Negro man climbing out the door of his car, a rural fella in a checkered shirt and soiled overalls, who considered the mess that had been made of his Ford. Its entire front end was stove in, completely limp and useless, except for this little white-hot hiss of steam shooting out like some starving cousin of Old Faithful. Now, by whatever principle of misfortune that was operating in Overlook, there was not another witness on that street, not another soul besides this man and my daddy and me, who'd seen my father come tearing round that corner as if the devil himself were in pursuit. And my father got out of his car, and he came up to this man. Not someone I knew, just some poor, terrified black fellow. And my father looked at him, and he pointed to his head, and he said, "Nigger, you see what you done? Now you've got 1 minute to get some of those other boys out here and get this car of yourn out of my way, or I'm going to be calling Bill Clayburg, and I'm going to have him run you in." Well, I suppose I should have been used to that. I can't tell you how my father treated the sharecroppers. When I was a boy, there was one fellow who had accidentally killed a cow, and my father and Billy Clayburg, the sheriff, and some other white men hog-tied that fellow and held him under the river until he admitted killing that cow and agreed to let the price of that cow be taken out of the pitiful sum that was called his wages. But this wasn't the plantation. This was town, where my father was, as a general matter, better behaved. But I guess his true colors, so to speak, were showing. And he looked that poor man up and down, that poor black man who stood there wondering, can this really be happening? Can this white man just shoot around a corner, drunk enough that you can smell it standing 5 foot away, and make a total wreck out of my car that I worked so hard for, and give me not a penny's recompense? Can he do that? Or is there some small particle of goodness in the world that will prevent that? And then he looked past my father and caught sight of me in the front seat. His eyes loitered on mine. It wasn't a plaintive look, 'cause this man knew better than that, and he was surely too proud to beg. He just looked and kind of asked me in a way, "You too? You gonna do this too? Is this here going on and on?" I knew what he wanted, and so did my daddy. And he just said, "Don't you look at him. He's seen the same as I have." And I said not a word. Well, that fellow didn't have any choice then, and soon enough, the man did what my daddy told him. He went in and out of some of the little houses with their tar paper sides, and collected some of his kin, some friends from out of a store up on the next corner, and by, they came out and pushed the car out of the way, and we left there. And my father, he wasn't done. He rolled his window down and said, "Don't you niggers let this happen again, neither." And I say this is the worst story I know because I just watched. I was 14 years old. But I knew right from wrong. I knew brute authority from justice. And I spoke not a word. Not because my heart didn't ache to do it, but because I lacked the courage. I hadn't planned my escape well enough in my mind. I hadn't yet prepared the path to my own freedom. Oh, I wept my eyes out that night and the nights following. And my resolve grew. And I swore to myself that whatever happened, I would never tie my tongue out of fear of my father or anyone else who was doing what I knew to be plain wickedness. In the years since, I have often heard my father say he raised his worst enemy in his own home, and I take pleasure when I hear him saying that. Because however else I judge myself, I think at least I've kept my word. He looked up to be sure he had my attention. The voice of a neighbor's TV drifted through the apartment, a commercial for a fast food chain that seemed boldly inappropriate. "Now, I don't know a thing about you and your father, Seth, but let me tell you this much.
free yourself. If you are going to do something as dramatic as running away from your country and allowing some grand jury to indict you and the FBI to hunt for you coast to coast, make sure that it's not for nothing and that you are free on your own terms. If you can't make my revolution, then make your own revolution. Make the revolution you can and triumph at it. That's what I say.
He lifted up his sleeping boy and barely brought his lips to Niall's brow, while his eyes remained on me, knowing that, as ever, he'd made a deep impression.
Edgar was expelled the next day, April 30th. More than three-quarters of the faculty voted in favor. Jeering members of 100 Flowers were dragged off by Damon's finest as they stood with placards, heckling the president of the university when he returned home from the meeting. Edgar addressed the cameras of virtually every California television station. Freedom of speech and thought, he said, the supposed cardinal values of university life, had been exposed, he said, as a fiction, a sham, a quilted coverlet masking the iron face of political rigor and reactionary values. In spite of the high drama, Edgar's story did not remain at the top of the news. By 11 p.m., when Michael and I took our places in the bedroom where I'd moved the TV set in deference to Niall's sleep, the lead item was Richard Nixon's address to the nation earlier in the evening. I had read that the speech was coming, but, like everyone else, never anticipated the content. Now Nixon announced he was sending U.S. soldiers into the Cambodian fishhook to rout out North Vietnamese supplies and troops, and also bombing their supply routes in Laos. The screen filled with Nixon's shadowy, humorless mug as the president, in one of his Orwellian fabrications, assured the nation that the war was not expanding. "Can you believe this?" I asked Michael, who replied with a limp shrug. The newsreader ran on to other matters. Edgar's expulsion, the news that the judge at the Kopechne inquest had questioned Edward Kennedy's veracity, suspicion that Juanita Rice and her captors had robbed another bank in West L.A. Michael eventually slipped out, saying he was sleepy, while I continued fulminating. After all Nixon's talk about how the war was winding down, he was invading another nation. After all the protests, the marches, the mobilized dissent, after all my pain, Nixon was still in the spell of the generals and his ingrained paranoia. He was refusing to bow to the commies as always, struggling to win a war he could only lose, killing young men for the ego and profit of old ones, and proving, as if he meant to, the correctness of those who had contended all along that only far more dramatic measures would breed change. Within the hour, I heard voices blaring behind the apartment. Out on Campus Bull, protesters had commandeered the microphone at a drive-through fast food restaurant and were exclaiming in the amplified voice, "Dick Nixon! Dick Nixon!" Another group was in the middle of the street, bringing traffic to a skidding halt and chorusing back something similar about Spiro Agnew. I hung through the open window. At top volume, I screamed right along, "Dick Nixon," yelling until Niall woke and my throat felt so raw, I imagined it might be bloody. With the news the following morning, I came to believe that I'd been briefly wrested from my sleep by the boom of what I took for a storm. That remains my memory, a single vague concussive pock bouncing off the clouds. I'm still not certain. I was in the shower just after 5 when I heard footsteps thundering up the stairs, a determined pounding,
oblivious of the hour. There was a single phenomenal bang overhead, which seemed to shake the building, and then, I was sure, shouting. I opened the front door of the apartment and saw three Damon coppers on the landing. They were in full battle gear, helmets and shiny boots and bulletproof vests. They had their riot batons drawn, and one of them saw me and said, "Get back inside!" I had only a towel around my waist, but even half naked, I found that my reflexive regard for high authority had fled. "Go fuck yourself," I replied. It was a sign of how my sense was failing. He reared back as if he had been struck, lifting his baton from his side. There were shouts above, and footfalls again shook the wooden stairwell so hard I could feel them. With his arms cuffed from behind, Edgar was pushed down the steps with a cop at each side. "What the hell?" I asked. I thought Edgar smiled as he went by. His dark hair was tousled, and he wore pants but no shoes and socks. The three cops, including the one who was prepared to hit me, took off to clear the way. They wrestled Edgar down the stairs and threw him in the back of a squad car parked below, whose noisy radio voice I'd heard but hadn't really noted. When I looked up, June stood a few feet in front of her threshold in her long, white night shift, clutching Niall, who wore solely his large diaper. Only now he began to cry. Behind them, I could see the door of the apartment, smashed off the hinges and split. Fresh wood was revealed in the rent, as with a lightning-struck tree.
"What in God's name?"
I brought them into my apartment. June was shaking. I dressed Niall and laid him down on my sofa. The diaper, of course, was soaked. I spent a great deal of time soothing him, and June soon joined me. Apparently, he had not seen most of it, but Niall was awake as his father had been cuffed and hustled out. June and I kept assuring him that Edgar was all right. Finally, he accepted our advice and, with little warning, went back to sleep. June and I sat in the kitchen, drinking tea and whispering.
"They just broke in?"
"They said they had an arrest warrant. I never saw it."
She lit a cigarette. In an act of hapless modesty, she had thrown an old green knitted shawl over herself before leaving her apartment. She sat in my kitchen in her cotton nightdress, clutching her bare arms.
"For what? What are they busting him for?"
She pondered her cigarette.
"The bomb,"
she said.
"Last night, about 1 in the morning, actually, the ARC was bombed. The whole west wing of the building was destroyed. Most of the labs over there."
She described the explosion scene, dust and bricks blown a quarter of a mile. I asked about injuries.
"The building was,"
she said and stopped.
"You'd think the building would be empty. They're saying—"
June faltered again.
"Someone was in his lab late. One of the profs. He's hospitalized. They claim he lost his hand, an arm."
"Oh, God. And they arrested Edgar for it?"
"This is what it's going to be like. Now, I keep telling him that. This is what the faculty did. This is what they've intended. They've stripped away the last vestiges, the last protective plumage of class membership. This is going to happen again and again. Any occasion, any excuse. It doesn't matter how careful we are. You understand that, don't you?"
She leaned in toward me with rare directness and grasped my hand. Over time, my relationship with June had acquired a subtle, confidential air, beginning, I guess, the day I saw her in all her glory on Michael's threshold. On nights she was home before Edgar, she poured herself 2 fingers of bourbon, an indulgence she occasionally allowed herself, particularly outside his presence, and talked to me about her household. With the tumbler in hand, she could emit a languorous air, taking all her weight on her heels, an elbow laid on the kitchen countertop. Sometimes she worried out loud about Niall, his social adjustment, his reading. Occasionally, there were candid remarks about Edgar, issued as her eye rose to meet mine above her glass, which I knew I was expected to maintain in strictest privacy. For me, she was a bit of a confidant as well. I told her about my parents and, of course, as I did with everyone else I knew, poured out my anguish to her about my breakup with Sonny. But she spoke to me now as I imagined she talked to someone else, someone who knew her far better than I did.
"We have to get out of here," June said. "I keep telling him that. He won't listen. He doesn't care. He thinks he's prepared for what's coming. He wants it to happen to him. He still believes that suffering is good for the soul. He's still wound up in so many crazy ideas. I keep telling him to think about Nile, and he keeps asking me if I don't love the revolution, repeating that a child can't be harmed by the truth."
She stubbed out the cigarette emphatically. She massaged her neck and wondered aloud if she should have a drink to collect herself, and then concluded that it would be better not to get started. The day would be difficult enough. With her own thoughts, she stood and strolled barefoot about the apartment. The tassels of the shawl were brought close to her mouth. I was struck how Edgar's enigma loomed even to June, more unfathomable than these strange events. She paused before the empty bookcases along the walls, relics of Sonny's departure. The thought of my troubles apparently provided a respite from her own.
"How's the heart?"
she asked. "A mess." During the days, I had taken to repeatedly playing on my phonograph a terrible, overproduced version of "You Keep Me Hangin' On" by Vanilla Fudge. With the music at 10, I screamed along with the mounting clamor of cymbals and the whining guitars. Everyone for three blocks must have